Hello, I'm Chris Basden, an editor with AICPA's Journal of Accountancy. You're listening to the J of A podcast. We talk about the key issues facing the accounting profession. Tax reform is definitely one of those key issues that CPAs are interested in. And on Wednesday, September 27th, Republican lawmakers released a framework for tax reform. As part of the announcement, they stated that their goals are to cut tax rates, simplify the Internal Revenue Code, and provide a more competitive environment for business. So what do CPAs need to know about the framework and how it might impact clients? We have a couple of guests with us today who are going to help answer those questions. The first is Alistair Nevius, the Editor-in-Chief of the Tax Advisor. Also joining us is Tony Nitti, a tax partner with Witham, Smith & Brown, and an editorial board member of the Tax Advisor. Tony, let's start with a basic question. Just what is in the framework?
Sure, Chris. Well, as you said, the goal of the framework, and I think this helps us to kind of understand what's in it, it's got multiple aspects. I mean, we want to reduce rates here, is certainly what the GOP was after here when the Big Six released the framework. But in doing so, in cutting tax rates for most Americans, you wanted to create simplicity, right? You want to leave the code a little bit more clear than it was when you started the process. And so it's probably, when we look at how they went about achieving that, it's probably best that we break things down into three sections, right? There's the individual changes, there are the business changes, and then there are a couple international changes. So just starting with the individual changes, right? The first thing that's going to grab headlines is just the change in what we call ordinary income tax rates. So the rates that we pay on, you know, for example, our salaries. Under current law, right, there's seven different rates, 10, 15, 25, 28, 30, 3.35, and a top rate of 39.6. What the framework would do is reduce those rates and consolidate them down into three brackets, so we're left with a 12% rate, 25% rate, and a 35% rate, okay? Now, that's going to be done in conjunction with a couple other big changes, because you may have noticed that bottom rate's going to jump from 10 to 12%, which might leave you thinking, well, wow, you know, low-income taxpayers are going to see their bills increase. But one of the other big changes that's going to take place here is they are going to nearly double what we call the standard deduction, right? Every taxpayer gets to deduct the greater of their standard deduction or the sum of their itemized deductions. Well, the standard deduction's been $6,350. If you are single, double that, or $12,700 if you're married. Suddenly that would increase to $12,000 if you're single, $24,000 if you're married. And so that's going to help soften the blow for low-income taxpayers, because it's going to effectively create a larger 0% tax rate, because, you know, more of your first dollars of income will be sheltered from any income tax at all. But the other thing that increasing the standard deduction does is it achieves some of that simplicity that we're after, right? Because if the standard deduction is going to go up, then you would think fewer people will itemize. And that's exactly what's going to happen, because another big change that's going to come down according to this framework is the overwhelming majority of itemized deductions as we know them are going to disappear. The only things that will be left will be the deductions for mortgage interest and charitable contributions. So if you take those two things in tandem, right, a doubled standard deduction and eliminated itemized deductions, about 27 million more taxpayers would take the standard next year rather than itemize. And so that creates some simplicity, right? As tax preparers, if you've ever had to root through a shoebox full of receipts adding up medical expenses to compute itemized deductions, you know that taking the standard sometimes is, right, a much more simple process. And so for about 27 million taxpayers, that process would get more simple. So standard goes up, bunch of itemized get eliminated. And then another change at the individual level will be the fact that personal exemptions will be eliminated. And so every taxpayer is entitled to a $4,050 deduction for themselves, their spouse, all of their dependents. That would go away as part of the framework. And you know, it's something we got to keep our eye on. We can come back and kind of talk a little later, if you'd like, about the interplay between, you know, losing these personal exemptions, but gaining a higher standard, and, you know, who it might help, who it might hurt. But those are really the big changes that are going to be made at the individual level to how we kind of compute our income tax. Fewer rates, lower rates, double standard, less itemized, and then lost personal exemptions. Now, a couple other changes on the individual side, we would eliminate the alternative minimum tax, which again is going to create some simplicity. Anybody that's had to compute AMT knows that, again, it's not a very simple process. It adds a lot of time and effort into what is already a pretty difficult process sometimes in computing tax liability. So the AMT would go away. Also, the estate tax would go away. So if you know you're talking about that small percentage of taxpayers who are subject to the estate tax, that wouldn't apply anymore. The generation skipping tax would also disappear. So you're getting, you know, tax reduction at the individual level, and then you're going after simplicity with some of these changes we talked about. Then on the business side of things, really there's three changes worth mentioning here today. Number one, the corporate tax rate, right? It's currently at 35% for C corporations. Both Republicans and Democrats have said over the years it needs to come down. Right now it's being proposed to settle at 20%. So the theory goes, you drop that corporate rate down to 20%, it's going to encourage more U.S. businesses to invest in Michigan rather than Mexico, and we're able to keep more businesses, more jobs, more income here in the U.S. But perhaps the most fascinating aspect of the framework that was issued yesterday is how we're going to tax the income of S corporations and partnerships and sole proprietorships, right? I mean, under current law, those entities, those businesses don't pay tax at the entity level. Instead, the owners pay tax on their share of the business income at the individual level, where they have been at the mercy of their individual rates. And as we said, those rates can go as high as 39.6. Well, under the framework, right, the income earned by a shareholder in an S-corp or a partner in a partnership or a sole proprietor, they're going to be taxed at a unified, that income is going to be taxed at a unified 25% rate. So that means that someone who has been paying tax at 39.6% on their S-corp business income could suddenly overnight have a 15% reduction in their effective tax rate on that income. So that is significant. And then the third change is at least a partial move to what we call full expensing, right? Somebody goes out and buys a truck or a piece of machinery or even a building. We know that we have to wrestle not only with depreciable lives, but also various incentives to accelerate depreciation like bonus and 179. Well, here, right, the big six in their framework is embracing full expensing, which is exactly what it sounds like, you know, subject to some potential limitation to come down in future versions, but basically the ability to write off immediately all of the costs of asset acquisitions and improvements. And so what they're saying as of yesterday is that for 5 years at least, you'd be able to deduct 100% of your capital improvements. But that is a significant change that really fundamentally shifts the U.S. corporate or business tax system more towards almost a cash flow tax than anything else. And so those are the three big business changes. And then lastly, on the international side, there's two aspects. Number one, you know, we currently have what we call a deferral system of tax. So if a U.S. company through a foreign sub goes out and earns income in, you know, say China through a Chinese subsidiary, right, there's no U.S. tax on that income earned in China until the Chinese subsidiary repatriates that income back to the U.S. Because of that, there's tremendous motivation for the U.S. parent company not to repatriate that income and leave that income overseas. And so because of that motivation, there's reported to be anywhere from 2.5 trillion on up of income associated or related to U.S. corporations stashed overseas where it hasn't yet been subject to U.S. tax. So what they would do in the framework, with details to be determined, is assess a one-time tax or what they call a deemed repatriation to bring the tax on that income back to the U.S., even though the income hasn't been brought back to the U.S. So just for an example, if it was a one-time rate of 10% on 2.5 trillion, you're all of a sudden going to enjoy a windfall here in the U.S. of $250 billion of tax revenue. And so what they would do is that deemed repatriation, but then say to these multinational businesses, we're going to shift to a territorial tax system. And what that means is if you go out and earn income in China through a Chinese sub, we're going to let China tax that income. And when you repatriate it back to the U.S., we're not going to tax it a second time. And so it's a fundamental shift in the way we do things, because we basically are going to say, hey, let the world separate into its own little tax jurisdictions and let them tax, every country tax the income earned within its borders. And here in the U.S., you know, we're not going to try to kind of levy a double taxation on income earned by U.S. corporations around the globe. So I know that was a lot to throw at you for what was a relatively simple question, but those really were the big talking points to emerge from the framework yesterday.
So that's a really good overview of what's in there, but what is left out of the framework?
Well, a couple things that I think have left some people pretty frustrated. Number one, let's be honest, right? When you hear about tax reform, it's great that we just talked about deemed repatriation and full expensing, but what people really want to know is, what's my tax rate going to be? And while we know there's going to be rates of 12, 25, and 35, what they didn't give us at the individual level is where those rates are going to kick in. So we're all sitting here today and nobody really can say what bracket they're going to be in or how they're going to be impacted. And I think that's by design. You know, I think they want to buy some time for the tax writers to kind of look at how different kind of cutoffs for the brackets will impact classes of taxpayers differently. But it's a little frustrating that that wasn't part of the framework yesterday. The other interesting thing that was in there is the framework said that they're basically kind of reserving their right to tack a fourth tax bracket on top of the 12, 25, and 35, a higher bracket on the nation's wealthiest taxpayers. So whether that's 37, 38, whether they keep the current 39.6, they're basically just saying, hey, we have the right here to kind of add a fourth bracket and have a higher tax rate than the 35% that we're promising right now if we think we end up needing it. So that's something that's going to certainly leave the nation's wealthiest 2% of taxpayers going, well, now I really don't know my tax rate. You know, is it 35 or is it something higher? So, you know, there's obviously a lot of details that couldn't come out in the framework yesterday, and some are more important than others that we don't have. But those are the two things that I think a lot of people are wondering about today.
Thanks, Tony. So, Alistair, I know that you have some questions about income brackets. Why don't we delve into those now?
All right. Thanks, Chris. So as you mentioned, we don't know where the brackets are going to start and stop. And as you mentioned, there is this possible fourth bracket that may be added. But on the other hand, we do know there's going to be a larger standard deduction. When our readers and our listeners have clients coming in and asking them questions, is it possible from what we know now to assess how these new tax rates are going to affect individuals?
Yeah, that's a great question, Alistair. Now, I'd say no for two reasons. Number one, again, we simply don't know where the breaks in the rates are going to come in, and that's critical. I mean, we can look back at the plan that President Trump campaigned on, and he had the breaks laid out there. We can look back at the blueprint for tax reform that was released by Kevin Brady and Paul Ryan back in 2016, and they had breaks in their tax rates. But, you know, that doesn't mean that's where they're going to settle now. So it would be pure speculation. The other thing we don't know that would make computing a tax liability very difficult is how we had talked previously about personal exemptions being taken away. Well, there was some mention in the framework that they're going to try to soften that blow by enhancing and increasing the child tax credit. But right now, we simply don't have the details around that. And so if a family wanted to compute their tax liability, it would be really hard to get, you know, kind of a reasonable estimate, because the personal exemptions for each child and the spouse are gone. And in theory, they may be somewhat replicated in an enhanced child tax credit, but we don't have the detail of exactly how those child tax credits would work. So if you try to compute your liability on your own, it's pretty likely you'd end up with a higher liability than what might end up being the reality.
Okay. And another, you know, one of the goals of the framework is tax simplification. They are proposing fewer tax brackets for individuals. Do you think this really amounts to simplification, or does the, do you think the framework is going to result in actual simplification for individuals?
Well, you know as well as I do, Alistair, right? There are no shortages of complicating factors in the Internal Revenue Code, right? I mean, it's between the code and the regs, it's 8 volumes. It's full of exceptions to exceptions and thresholds and limitations. The complexity in the tax law is not found in the number of brackets. It's just not. But for some reason, simplicity is always seems to be associated with fewer brackets, even though, you know, understand fewer brackets poses some problems as well, because it means that as you cross over from one bracket to another, your jump in tax rate is pretty significant, right? Under current law, you might jump from 33 to 35 or 25 to 28. But under the framework, when you only have 3 brackets, it means when you leave that 25% bracket, your next dollar of income is being taxed at 35. That's a 10% jump. So, you know, there's some downside to fewer brackets too, but I think people like to conceptualize fewer rates, fewer brackets as being symbolic of a code that's more manageable, of a tax law that they can handle. I don't know that it's really the case, but in all walks of life, perception often dictates reality. So if fewer brackets makes people feel like the law is simpler, that's probably a good thing.
So let me jump in here with another question. With the personal exemptions rolled into the standard deduction, the standard deduction raised, and most itemized deductions going away, what effect will this have on average taxpayers?
Yeah, that's a great question and one that a lot of people want answered. And I'll tell you why we can't answer that just yet. Is increasing the standard deduction sounds great, right? But if you lose personal exemptions, then there's going to be a tipping point where if you have a, you know, a family of a certain size, you're not going to be happy with these changes. I mean, just think about it like this. If you've got a married couple, right, with 4 kids, would you rather have, under current law, a $12,700 standard deduction plus 6 $4,000 personal exemptions, so total deductions of around $36,000, or would you rather have the new framework where you've got a $24,000 standard deduction but no personal exemptions? I'm no genius, but 36,000 is greater than 24,000. So I would rather have a lower standard in personal exemption if I have 4 kids. And so at first blush, you might say, oh, wait, this great, you know, higher standard deduction is great. But if you have a bunch of kids, you're going to end up losing out on this deal. And like I said, that's certainly how it looks. But what you have to remember is the framework says that they're going to try to kind of ameliorate that by rolling those lost personal exemptions into a higher child tax credit. Now, we don't know exactly how it would work or where the, you know, phase outs are going to come in. And so we're just kind of left here wondering, you know, might there be some middle class, upper middle class taxpayers who lose those personal exemptions, but get phased out of even these enhanced child tax credits. And so they actually end up worse off under this new law than they were under old law, even though their tax rate has dropped. And just a few hours ago, right, Gary Cohn came out and said he can't guarantee that some middle-class taxpayers won't experience a tax increase because of the way these different provisions work together. And so to me, that's one of the more fascinating things. I think that low-income taxpayers will be largely protected because, again, their lost personal exemptions should be rolled into an allowable child tax credit. But as you move up the income scale, I do think you'll find kind of an anomaly where a certain class of taxpayers loses the personal exemptions, obviously, but also doesn't benefit from the enhanced child tax credit simply because they make too much money. So it's going to be really interesting to keep our eye on. And when we do have enough detail to determine how the child tax credit works, to figure out if there's anybody that does get stung by this confluence of changes.
And staying on the business side of the changes, is there any way to sort of predict how the combination of a lower corporate tax rate and fewer deductions and 100% expensing are going to play out for the average business?
Yeah, I think there is. I think we can be reasonably certain that even though we talk about eliminating deductions, the combination of those three changes is going to result in tax cuts for the overwhelming majority of businesses. Because, you know, when the economists end up scoring these things, dropping the tax rate from 35% to, for example, 20% for a C corporation, that's about a $1.8 trillion tax cut over the next 10 years. Then if you talk about full expensing, even for just 5 years, that's about another $1.2 trillion in tax cuts over the next 10 years. So you're talking about $3 trillion of tax cuts. And if you were to eliminate pretty much every single corporate expenditure, you know, other than kind of your page one, you know, rent and cost of goods sold and advertising, everything except those and say the R&D credit and the credit for low-income housing, all of those things, you wipe out every other deduction and it only raises about $1 trillion of revenue over the next 10 years. So you're looking at $3 trillion of tax cuts versus $1 trillion of clawed back revenue. We're talking about $2 trillion of tax cuts related to the combination of corporate changes here. And so, you know, while this threat is dangled out there of eliminating a lot of corporate deductions, trust me, C corps, particularly profit, you know, big C corps, would happily trade the Section 199 deduction and a handful of other, you know, special interest and industry specific deductions if it means they're getting back a 20% rate and the ability to fully expense all their acquisition costs of assets.
So, Tony, now that the framework is out there, what's going to happen next procedurally?
Well, as crazy as it sounds, the next big step really doesn't have much to do with tax law, right? We've got to get a budget passed. The House and Senate have to agree on a budget, and that budget has to establish the allowable amount of tax cuts over the next 10 years, because that's the framework that the GOP is ultimately going to have to work within as they seek to pass tax reform, right? If they pass a budget that says you can have up to $1.5 trillion of tax cuts over the next 10 years, then the GOP could craft a tax bill that provides for $1.5 trillion in cuts over the next 10 years and pass that using what's called the reconciliation process, where they would only need 51 votes out of the Senate, where Republicans currently control 52 seats. So they wouldn't need a single vote of Democratic approval. But before you can use that reconciliation process and, you know, pass a tax reform bill, you got to pass a budget. And that could be a bigger undertaking than anybody fully appreciates, just because of how divided things are right now on fiscal policy. So once a budget gets passed, then, you know, somebody in the House will start writing up an actual piece of legislation. It'll go to House Ways and Means Committee and eventually turn into something that we can all kind of analyze and beat up and talk about with all of the missing details that we have at this time.
And Tony, this may be the most important question that we can ask you, given our audience. What can tax practitioners be doing now to prepare themselves and their clients?
Well, you know, Chris, there's part of me that feels silly answering this question, because last year at this time, you know, I was traveling around the country teaching federal tax updates all over, telling people, here's what we should be doing at the end of 16 to prepare for 17, because we're going to have a new tax law in 17. And here we are a year later, repeating the same thing. And who's to say at the end of 18, we won't still be sitting here analyzing proposals for tax law, wondering what's going to come to fruition. But with that, I think that this year, you know, you really kind of more than ever want to embrace the two tenets of tax planning, right? Number one, defer income as much as you can. And it's more important this year than ever, because it's very likely your income next year is going to be taxed at a lower rate, whether you're a C corp, whether you're an S corp owner, whether you're an individual. To the extent you can defer income into 18, right? If any of these changes happen in 18, that income is likely going to be taxed at a lower rate. And then the second tenet, right, accelerate deductions. Well, this year, more than ever, you really want to accelerate deductions, because remember what I said, 27 million more taxpayers will be taking the standard next year versus itemizing if these changes come through. That means for 27 million taxpayers, their itemized deductions aren't going to do them a lick of good next year. And so if you're contemplating, you know, having surgery on your knee here at the end of 17 or the beginning of 18, I would encourage you to have it done at the end of 17, right? Accelerate those itemized deductions into 17, because for 27 million taxpayers, they're not going to do you any good. And then even if you're not one of those 27 million taxpayers, right, the framework said that they're going to eliminate all itemized deductions other than mortgage interest and charitable contributions. So it does you little good to incur medical expenses next year, or personal property taxes that you might be paying, things that may not be available to you next year. And so you just got to educate your clients as much as you can, make sure they understand the uncertainty behind any of this, but explain to them that two principles of tax planning that we tend to always abide by, you know, deferring income and accelerating deductions, they're probably more important this year than ever, because what you don't want to have happen is come in next year as a client with a bunch of itemized deductions and have your tax advisor say to you, hey, did I forget to tell you that the new law effective 1/1/18 means you don't get to deduct any of those, and you probably should have taken them in December of 17. So sit down with your clients, let them know that tax reform, you know, is not a linear process. We could be going two steps forward, one step back for a while, but that doesn't mean we should ignore it. And it means that, you know, things we probably would have been doing anyway, deferring income, accelerating deductions, are things we should pay a great deal of attention to at the end of 17.
Thanks, Tony and Alistair. And I'd also like to thank our audience for listening today. If you enjoyed this podcast, check out more JFA podcasts on our website and on Podomatic.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.